Is mental illness to be treated as a purely material problem, or is mind disease spiritual only, with no legitimate use for psychiatric drugs? Or is there a third option? That's the topic today on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
I'm your guest host today, Mike Keyes, and we will have our final conversation with J.P. Moreland about his book, Finding Quiet. J.P. Moreland's books include a bunch of great titles, but one that I hadn't mentioned yet is his also relatively new book, Scientism and Secularism, Learning to Respond to a Dangerous Ideology. Welcome back, J.P., to the show.
It's good to be with you, my brother.
Okay, so in the last episode, you were mentioning how developing new practices is like sort of cutting out new grooves on the surface of the neural tissue in the brain, if you will. So this metaphor of carving out grooves, as you repeatedly practice something, it becomes a habit or a practice, and that you can actually change your brain chemistry through mental effort over a period of time. I think that's a very helpful perspective, and it has personally helped you, hasn't it, JP?
Oh, it's I went through 8 surgeries from 2015 for the next until about 2017, and I had 3 kinds of cancer. I had a pacemaker put in. I had chemotherapy, 2 rounds of radiation. And I'm telling you, through the whole thing, I was filled with joy and peace and had absolutely no anxiety at all. My family and my friends looked at me and said, "What in the world has happened to you? I mean, you're so different." And I'm a straight shooter, Michael. I don't make stuff up or exaggerate. I am telling you the truth, that I was changed because I had engaged in these practices myself. And that's why I wrote the book, because I am a sufferer, and I had tested them out of my own life and found that they really helped. So one thing I will add is that there is this notion called neuroplasticity that is widely recognized as true in neuroscience. And it's biblically consistent too, because that means that you can change not only your brain chemistry, but you can change your brain structure by changing the way you think. So they've done brain scans on people that are highly anxious, and there are regions of the brain that you can see are damaged. And they've told people, for the next 3 weeks, when you start getting anxious, I want you to think such and such. Yeah. Even if you don't believe it, just think it. And keep doing that several times a day. 3 weeks later, they took a brain scan of these people, and the areas that had been damaged were significantly healed. They had been restructured. I'm calling it regrooved, to trigger peaceful and joyful emotions rather than fearful, depressive, anxious ones. And I think that neuroscience has discovered what Paul knew in Romans 6 and Romans 12 and elsewhere, that part of our spiritual and mental health involves training the organs of our body to have the right grooves and get rid of the bad grooves or the fleshly grooves. And so my book has practices in it that will help with that, in addition to spiritual and psychological practices.
So this neuroplasticity idea that you've just described, that's often captured by the phrase, neurons that fire together, wire together. So now, with that backdrop of knowledge of how habitual mental effort can not only change brain chemistry, but brain structure, How would you articulate the legitimate use of antidepressants, whether it's short-term or long-term, and how do you decide? I know you're not a practitioner, and you're giving more general advice, and I know people need to see their healthcare provider for specifics, but what general things can you say about the legitimate use of antidepressants in conjunction with or integrated with changing habits through what you could call spiritual formation practices, right?
Yeah. Yes. Let's concentrate on the brain chemistry for a minute instead of the brain structure. Think of the brain as a machine for a minute, like the car engine. The car engine works very smoothly if there's oil in it. But if you're driving your car and you're low or you don't have any oil at all, the parts of the engine are going to rub against one another, and it's going to cause a lot of friction and dysfunction. Now, that's exactly the same thing that's true of the parts of your brain. As long as there's oil in them, they work fine, and your mood, it will be strongly inclined towards being peaceful and joyful. But the oil is our neurotransmitters, things like serotonin and dopamine. And now what these do is they cause the neurons to fire properly, and your brain then triggers positive and emotions and good feelings and so on. Now, it's not just your brain. You can also trigger those by the way you think about, use your mind and the way you use your heart and so on. But this is one of the aspects. So I would say that if antidepressants are merely oil, or you might think of a vitamin, to put those neurotransmitters back into your brain, because you're not producing them normally on your own, because you've been so depleted by, say, long-term anxiety and depression. So my tip is that if you find that counseling and spiritual practices aren't helping you like they should, then I would say that your problem may very well now be biological in addition to psychological and spiritual. What that means is you might not be able to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And what you need to do is to have some medication that will get your brain back to kind of a normal level of oil. And at that point, you can go to work on your problems from a more spiritual and psychological way and have a fighting chance for that to work. But, you know, it's hard to rejoice in the Lord if somebody's hitting you your thumb with a hammer. And it's hard to rejoice in the Lord if your brain chemistry is messed up. If your anxiety is responding to psychological and spiritual practices like worship and solitude prayer, then no problem. But that would be my general rule of thumb, though I'm not a practitioner.
Sure, sure. It's always a good sort of a legal disclaimer there for even our own conversation here. So now back to this idea of neuroplasticity.
Yeah.
If someone has experienced a traumatic childhood, I mean, you know, massive abuse and so on, then neuroplasticity is in some way sort of working against them, in that it's changing the way their brain works, and that lingers in their adulthood. But on the flip side, I mean, you were emphasizing that neuroplasticity is sort of to our advantage, in that if we find ourselves in a situation where counseling and spiritual practices are helping somewhat, but maybe not fully solving it, that we need to take into account, well, there is that earlier history that's still affecting you. So, do you want to sort of summarize sort of the two sides of neuroplasticity? You know, earlier when you were young, you know, it may be working against you, but now it can, when you know that neuroplasticity is real, it can actually work in, to your favor.
Yes. So, Trauma and traumatic events, especially in childhood, can put grooves in your brain that are so deep that they just trigger anxiety and fear and depression. And that's the bad side of neuroplasticity, because those memory grooves stay in there. And you can, though, get rid of them through a certain kind, different kinds of counseling. And there's a specific type that works very well for a lot of people who have very, very deep traumatic memories. It's called EMDR therapy. And I don't really want to go into it in detail right now because it's hard to explain, but I have a whole treatment of it in the book, Finding Quiet. And I went to an EMDR therapist, and it was unbelievably helpful to me in a way that simple talk therapy, though I think that's important, was not able to get deep enough. And so I want to give, in the book, I give a whole range of practices. I give a complete biblical basis for medication, and I explain EMDR therapy and exercises for your heart muscle, your brain, and your soul and your mind that I have found have brought me tremendous peace.
That's great. JP, can you give just one example of a spiritual discipline practice that a listener could, you know, just pick up on and just try it out? That doesn't have to pay for counseling, just try it out in their own home.
The first practice is called the four-step solution, and it's widely recognized as effective, and it really is an application of taking every thought captive to Christ and the exhortation, Lord, search me and know me, examine me and see my anxious thoughts. And the four-step solution is just a practical application of that, and plus the passage of in Philippians 4, whatever's true and good and lovely and so on, keep your mind dwelling on those things. So it goes like this. The first thing you do is, step one, is that you ask the Spirit to help you become more aware of your self-talk that goes through your mind all throughout the day, that most of us are just paying no attention to it. And so what you do is you begin to become more aware of little self-talk thoughts that go through your mind, and they're negative. You're going to make a fool out of yourself at the meeting tomorrow. You better be worried. So the first thing you do is you spot the self-talk, and you call it. You say, hey, wait a minute, you're nothing but a habit brain message. You're a brain message that's a habit. That's all you are. You have no relationship to reality or to the meeting tomorrow. You're nothing but a bad habit I've got. And the second thing you do, in my book, I list what are called 10 thought distorters. These are ways that our thinking gets distorted. For example, my favorite one is that I catastrophize. I go, well, what if this happens? I'm worried about the future. And then I make it worse. Oh, my gosh. If that happens, it's going to be absolutely horrible. And so I spend all my time thinking about, if it happens, what I can do to, you know, escape it or to avoid it. Well, boy, that's terrible. So what you do is step two, you figure out which of the 10 this is, and you label it. You say, hey, you're not only a false brain message, but you are nothing but my habit of catastrophizing. And so that takes the power out of the thought. Step three is the most important. Instead of, and that's called refocusing, and instead of getting down in the mud and wrestling with a constant habituated thought that you have and telling yourself all the reasons why it's not true, why it's stupid, why it doesn't make any sense, and so on, which is actually digging the groove deeper and making the thought even harder to get rid of, believe it or not, you turn away from it. You say, I'm going to dismiss you. And you turn to do something which gets you into what's called flow. Flow is when you're so caught up in something, you lose track of time. So you turn away from the thought instead of wrestling with it, and you read a novel or check your email or do something that you like. It could be read a commentary on Matthew. I don't know. It doesn't have to be spiritual. It could be anything that you do that will get your attention play solitaire. You just get caught up in something else, and before you know it, that thought is way in the past. Step four, and I started off, and it took me doing this 20 minutes before I could get rid of the thought. Now it takes me 2 minutes because I've practiced it. Then step four is when the thought has no power, you go back and reevaluate the process and see how you did. Now, what that does is that if you do that repeatedly, it will take you anywhere from 22 days to 3 or 4 months. The average is 2.5 months. If you practice this, you're not going to be any good at it when you start, like you're not any good at the piano or Spanish if you first start. Don't let that bother you, because if you're learning a new practice, you're always going to be lousy in the early stages of trying to form a new habit. That's just normal. Stick with it, because in the early part, it's probably not going to do you much good. But as you keep practicing, guess what happens? The groove that triggers that thought evaporates, and it's replaced with a groove that triggers peace and joy. And it is a way of forming through neuroplasticity, getting rid of bad grooves and replacing them with – that's just changing habits is what we would call it ethically and biblically. And it really works. Michael, may I say one other thing?
Yeah, sure.
I just read the recent review on Amazon, and this dear sweet lady – said that reading the book, 3 days later, she had a panic attack, and she was able to use some of the practices in the book that in 3 or 4 minutes got rid of the anxiety and brought her a restoration of peace in her life. And she said it was just incredible. So some of the stuff can work immediately, but it usually takes time to form the new habit. Does that make sense?
It does. That's awesome, JP. You got a group of fans you're actually saying this stuff works. So
that's right.
And this is even better than the Boy Scout walking the old lady across the street. This is a dear woman whose life has been enriched by your scholarship and your life, in practice. So thanks so much.
You're welcome.
So this concludes our conversation about mental health in thinking both about mind and matter, and how both are important. I encourage listeners to go to Amazon to find J.P. Moreland's excellent book, Finding Quiet. I'm your guest host today, Mike Keyes. Thanks for joining us on Mind Matters.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.